Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 77 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Announcements this week. Outlander Stars gave us a new behind-the-scenes photo of Jamie and Claire. Very, very cute. They just look so cold. Like, that's what I take away from every...
Windy and cold.
Every picture that they have. Everyone just looks so cold. And I wonder how much extra makeup they have to put on the tips of their noses to make them not look like they're freezing. Because I know that when I'm out in a cold environment, my nose is, like, so red.
I wonder if they got a lot of wind chapping.
No. I would think they would keep them highly moisturized against that.
Underneath, yeah.
We also got our fourth of the month update for Droughtlander. And this week we got an awesome little video vignette.
They call it a look-ahead video.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was hosted by... I say hosted, it was really introduced. By Tobias Menzies.
Who was so cheeky and so funny. Oh,
but that's what... It was so nice to see that, because when you only see him as Blackjack, he doesn't have any of that.
In the outfit of Blackjack.
Right. Whereas, you know, when we met him and talked to him at the premiere, he was totally the opposite of his character. He was charming and warm and friendly. So this was nice to be able to see that side of him as well again. But it was a great little video. Featured our first look at Stephen Cree as Ian Murray. And a lot of little scenes, little still shots of things we haven't seen yet. And Random House announced this week that the Volume 2 of The Outlandish Companion has a release date of October 27th, 2015. Now, this one is a companion to The Fiery Cross, Breath of Stone Ashes, and Echo in the Bone, and Written in My Own Heart's Blood. So the first volume of The Outlandish Companion followed the first four books, mm-hmm. and the second volume will follow the next four books, and I imagine there will be a third volume when she finally finishes writing the entire series.
Oh, I hope so. I hope it's many years away. I mean, I want it because I want it now.
Right.
But I want it to last forever.
I agree.
So...
They state that Volume 2 is an all-new guide to the latest books and the strange, sprawling world that Claire Randall and Jamie Fraser call home. That was a quote. But I'm excited. I can't wait to have it. I used to have the first one, and I think I lost it in a move, which makes me incredibly sad. I hate to go back on my word and say that I would buy it as a hard copy, like as an actual book, because I don't own any books anymore.
But this is the kind of thing that I don't know if I'd want in e-copy.
Yeah.
I mean, if I do, then I can, but I would never not have the hard copy. It's just, it's a reference. It's not a read-through. To me, you can read through it. It's enjoyable, but you also want to go to certain pieces, certain parts. So that's why I would personally get it as a hard copy.
As a hard copy?
Yeah. I honestly probably would not buy this one. Electronically, just if that's just me.
Well, I haven't bought the first one electronically, so I mean,
yeah, me either.
I don't know. Decisions. That is our announcements for the week,
and now on to our read along. This week we are discussing chapter 16, The Nature of Sulfur.
So they do find out that Prince Charles. It's so weird to say because I think of the present-day Prince Charles,
right.
And I think you made a remark on that a few weeks ago. They find out that Prince Charles does indeed purchase his brandywine from Mr. Hawkins, the closet Jacobite. But not much more. They don't find much more out. They don't find out much more. Okay, word order. And that's not German coming out. That's just weird late-night English. Everything else was progressing as normal. Fergus and his letters, Louise and the husband, Claire and the vomiting. One breakthrough. Charles was bored. He started going out, and he invited Jamie to accompany him. But it seems all Jamie could get out of him were his views on women and hunting. Another breakthrough. Monsieur Duvarney, the Minister of Finance, lost at chess to Jamie multiple times, so they were invited to Versailles so as to give Monsieur Duvarney more of an opportunity to win. While at Versailles, Claire did her best to avoid alcoves. Apparently watching chess is boring. Have you ever watched chess? Only, like, in movies where people are having matches.
Okay, but whenever I watch... No, because whenever I watch, like, movies with chess and or TV shows with chess, they're all playing it at, like, hyper speed. So it's more like, move, and they slam that clock. Move, slam the clock. Move. So it's not like these games. These games, I'm imagining how I would play chess because I'm a terrible chess player. That I literally, like, a move is made, and then I sit there and I stare at it for, like, 15 minutes, like, trying to figure out the best position for my next move. But it's totally different from what I imagine is going on in this book. Like, in the book, I don't see it being a fast-paced, like, make a move, slam the clock down. Like, they're just, like, staring at it. And, like, I would imagine that would be incredibly mind-numbing to watch. To be one of the participants is probably very interesting.
If you know what's going on, an outsider, it could be enthralling. But I don't know how to say never going to be me, but likely never going to be me. So apparently watching chess is boring, but one of the admirers or observers says, "I shouldn't mind making the red-haired lad squeal and giggle," in reference to someone's joke about picking the fleas off of a page boy, because their response was to squeal and giggle. But they do find that part, the picking fleas off of page boys, would be more entertaining than chess. Claire could tell from watching Jamie that he had already won, and it was just a matter of time before the game was finished. Also, his mind was not on the game. We know exactly how she knows this. Ellen G. writes, "Claire knew it wasn't the chess by Jamie's tell, the middle fingers of his right hand moving against his thigh."
I was just going to say, his mind was on a game, just not the game.
The chess game.
The game of the larger picture, the game of them trying to thwart the Jacobite rebellion.
You know, I just got a flash, not a flashback, no. I never played chess, so there's nothing to flashback to. I just had a thought. I mean, this is very obvious, and speaking of all the looking up of symbolism stuff that's coming up that, yes, you're welcome for, I didn't care to write anything about the symbolism of chess. It's called the Gang of...
The gang?
It's called the Game of Kings. And though Jamie's not a king, he's a king of men. So technically, he's a king, as you say. I hate that, but he's a king. Anyway, yes, it was a way to get them back to Versailles. But if you think about it, it's also step back a little bit. Although Diana does not, you know, her novels have shapes, and none of the shapes is a chessboard or a chess piece. You could say that. No. A literal and symbolic game, because it's all of the kings, all of the rulers.
It's true, but you and I have a different view of chess, because we've read the book The Eight.
Oh, gosh.
Which was very chess-related. And
which, if you had told me, and I think I did tell you, if you had told me, hey, read this book about chess, I'd say,
right.
F off.
Right, exactly. But honestly, that book totally made me interested in the game of chess, and I thought
I still can't play, but... it's interesting.
I mean, I understand how to play. I have no like head for strategy and or any of the special moves. But you know, that book totally got me interested in it for a while. But it is the game of kings. It's the game of king makers. It's the game of you know, the king is dead, long live the king. So the entire premise of the game, which is totally, you know, good and makes sense for this series, is that the pretender is trying to regain his king, his kingdom, and his crown. Mm-hmm. So the king, it's always, you know, it's always kill the king, get the king, corner the king. And with him possibly trying to incite a rebellion to regain his throne, it's totally chess related. I can totally see it.
The footman offers Claire wine during the evening, but she turns him away. Diana writes, quote, "I had had enough during the evening that my head was feeling light and my feet dangerously far away." She sees the Comte Saint-Germain across the room, and I wrote, oh, fun. He had an annoying smile on his face, and he had an annoying smile on his face as he was looking at her, as she takes off with the ladies. She is trying to draw conversation to Scotland and its exiled king as much as possible. When she mentions Charles Stuart, the usual response was a rolling of the eyes or a shrug of dismissal. So basically, no one really gives a rat's. He's not interesting at all. Louis was still not inviting Charles to court, and a poor exile who was not in the king's favor wasn't going to find support in the city's financial elite. Apparently, the king's opinion of England and its remaining Protestant was akin to, quote, they can all burn in hell. Claire thinks, I thought we might be able to accommodate this sort of disappointment. Also, apparently, quote, Jacobites were a bore. Because the chess match had gone on so long, Jamie and Claire were once again offered an appartement to stay over at Versailles. Jamie warns that he might dream of chess, and he says to Claire, I hope it will not disturb you, Sassenach, if I castle in my sleep. Now, can you please tell me, what does that mean?
Okay, a castle. And this is literally the only chess move that I know. So I feel like I'm
Like a slapper?
No, okay. I'll tell you what a castle is. A castle is an opening move in a chess game. Where you, if you move two pieces specifically, you can move your king to one spot and your castle and your rook to another. Mm-hmm. And it basically fortifies your king behind a row of pawns and it moves your rook into a defending position. Now, you can only literally do this if you make specific moves in the beginning of the game and you can only make this move once. So you have, like, it's an opening move, basically, that you have to do.
But what would that mean for him being in bed with Claire? Would he, like, just, like, tweak her or something?
No, it just, to me, what I took from that is that he was going to be dreaming about chess.
Yeah, but why, if he castled in his sleep, how would that ever disturb her?
Well, it would, okay, if someone were to
try and grab her?
No, I don't think grab her. It's a protective maneuver, which means he would probably, because you're fortifying your position with the king.
Like, so holding her or something.
Okay. You're putting your king in a very protective position where he's got more protection. He's got all the pawns in front of him. He's got a rook to the side of him. And, you know, he's very, to get at him, you have to get through other pieces. So the only thing I could take from that is that he is saying that he is, you know, basically going to smother her in her sleep in a protective manner.
And her response is, you can stand on your head in your sleep if you want. Nothing will bother me tonight.
Want a bit?
Yeah. Okay, we know what's going on because we've read this before, but this was the first time that I picked up on what may, or may not, be a specifically chosen animal. Claire's having bad digestive trouble, gut pains, writhing pains. In her sleep, she imagines snakes in her belly. I thought that the snake was an interesting choice because, besides being good slitherers. According to Wikipedia, the serpent has several symbolic values, and we will link to this website in our show notes. Fertility and rebirth. Okay, this is kind of obvious. She's pregnant. She's a time traveler, so she has been symbolically rebirthed in another century. Guardianship. We'll come back to this one. Poison and medicine. She's a healer, and we'll also revisit this one. Vengefulness and vindictiveness. We'll come back to these, LOL. Sorry. Like, basically,
like, are we coming back to these, like...
We're hinting.
Like, in the near future, or are we talking, oh, like, no, in a few years?
In about 20 minutes.
Oh, 20 minutes.
Yeah, okay. Tonight, in this episode.
Okay,
girl,
I just want to say...
I am not that much of a tease.
I'm just saying, we've read the entire series, and I don't know if this is something that's, like, foreshadowing for, like, four books from now.
I think you could put this into probably any book, but no, this chapter.
Okay.
Specifically in the Judeo-Christian mythology, the serpent lured Eve with the promise of forbidden knowledge. Claire is a time traveler who has knowledge that no other has. She's shared that knowledge with Jamie, of course, we know. The snake is also portrayed as a deceptive creature or trickster in the Judeo-Christian mythology.
I totally thought you were going to say jujitsu. I have no idea why.
In the jujitsu, snakes are tricksters. In John, the Gospel of John, Jesus makes direct comparison between the raising up of the Son of Man and the act of Moses in raising up the serpent as a sign, using it as a symbol associated with salvation. Quote, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. According to the website spiritanimal.info, the snake spirit animal represents healing, transformation, life changes. The spirit of the snake is connected to life force, primal energy. A meaning for the snake spirit animal is spiritual guidance. I'm not sure the latter, spiritual meanings, or for that matter, any of them are apropos, but it is always interesting to visit symbology. Anyway, Diana mentions the snake, but Claire then describes it as plural. My skin was hot to the touch and my intestines coiled, turning into snakes themselves, biting and thrashing as they twined together. Jamie is trying to figure out what's wrong with Claire. The maid assigned to their appartement is trying to figure out what's wrong with Claire. More and more people come in. Then Monsieur Flesh, the royal physician, comes in and examines her. Claire notices the pain is moving downward to her lower abdomen. The doctor says that she is not having a miscarriage. Some of the young maids are noticing Jamie's scars, and I felt, oh man, how awful is that? Here he is worried. Of course he's not thinking about covering up. He's only worried about Claire and the babies. I could only imagine, you know, like you're giving them fodder for much more gossip and all of this stuff. The doctor goes on about humors, and Claire calls him an idiot. Even in her pain, she calls him these words, and he calls his assistant Plato. Now, I'm sure it was his name, but I find this highly amusing since the theory of humorism went back to the time of the ancient Greeks and Hippocrates.
Also, who was poisoned? Which one of the like long time ago famous like Greeks was poisoned?
Oh,
was it Aristotle or Galileo?
Galileo.
I don't know. I'm like a glass in. You can't even judge me.
He was not an ancient Greek.
Okay, Ro, totally delete all of that.
No, that's awesome.
No, delete it.
He's like a Catholic Italian scientist.
Just delete it.
Start over.
Which one of the Greek, like, teachers? There was, like, one of the, like, ancient Greek teachers who was poisoned.
And it wasn't Galileo. I had to do it. Okay, we're done. It's gone. It was just so perfect, Summer.
Oh, you're a dick. Okay, so wasn't one of, like, the famous, like, Greek, like, teachers, like, Socrates or Plato or one of those, one of them was poisoned. Was forced to take poison. Yes,
forced to drink poison as an executionary device or method. He was forced to drink hemlock. I want to say...
I'll look it up.
I don't even want to say. I know who I think it might be, but I could be totally wrong. But we'll both check it up.
When we Google, like, poisoned Greek teacher... Poisoned ancient Greek?
Ah, Socrates.
Okay, then. Socrates.
Socrates was, according to Wikipedia, Socrates was ultimately sentenced to death by drinking a hemlock-based liquid.
There you go. My point being, for them to bring up Plato, you said Plato, right? Wasn't one of their people named Plato? Didn't you just say
that? One of the helpers. Wait, yeah. Did you just say for them to what?
For them to bring up Plato.
Ah, I heard ring up.
No, bring up. Bring up. For them to bring up Plato, it made me think of other, like, Greek scholars. And I was like, I'm pretty sure one of them was poisoned at one point.
Yeah.
Not 100% stupid. Everyone pay attention.
The doctor wants to bleed her, and she basically says, over my dead body. So Jamie pulls back Plato, who was walking toward them with the basin and lancet. The ladies in the room are freaking out because of said lancet being pointed around in their direction, and it is high drama and excitement for these ladies. Claire was looking at the women and noticed one person who was watching her carefully. And this woman leaned over to one of her companions and said the word poison. Claire then realized what it was. Not poison exactly, but bitter cascara.
Like, legit. The whole transition into the next scene where she's, like, ripping into Master Aemon and she's like, I just, like, crapped myself in front of a room full of people. I'm like, that whole scene was so... embarrassing. Like, I felt the embarrassment on her behalf because of that, because I'm like, pooping is a very private thing, I think.
Yeah, and that's all we're gonna say. So my last line of that paragraph was, and then she had explosive diarrhea, comma, publicly.
Dude.
Okay, so let's now revisit some of the symbology that I put off of the serpent. Poison and medicine. Here we have poison. Claire believes she was poisoned, but by whom? More symbolism. Back to vengefulness and vindictiveness. Wouldn't someone who wanted to poison someone else have feelings of revenge or vindictiveness toward them? Just maybe. Now, whom does Diana go to right after the poisoning scene? Master Raymond. Ellen G.
Is it Raymond or Ramon?
What? It's R-A-Y-I-Y.
I don't speak a lick of French.
I used to.
No, I never did. I mean, like, the only French I ever spoke was...
8th grade or 7th grade.
It was 8th grade, and I literally counted to 10. That was it.
Try it now.
Nope. It was like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's it. That's all I got.
That's not bad.
I can't vouch for my pronunciation. I'm just
saying. It wasn't bad.
That's it.
A French person would most likely understand that.
Plus, they would also probably go, she's not.
Doesn't matter. They would understand it. Oh, girl, they wouldn't think I was French. Come on now. Ellen G. writes, Claire did know whom to go to, and in fact, Master Raymond was uneasy at her entrance.
Under the circumstances, he should be.
She lays straight into him. He's a little bit put out to find out Jamie was there, but says that at least she's alive. But you aren't dead, Madonna. You could have been, you know. What was that last bit of symbology of the serpent? Guardianship. Master Raymond, by not allowing her to be poisoned, by giving someone bitter cascara, is acting as a sort of guardian, no? If indeed that was that path. He does also point out, though, that it may not just be his scruples that led to her not being poisoned to death. It could be that someone didn't want her dead, that it could have been a joke, but he only sold it to two people and neither of them asked for it. FYI. So now she has two potential poisoners.
You're totally going to cut this out after I say it, but when you went to say scruples, I totally thought you were going to say scrotum.
So what was the line? Oh, because I said... May not be just his screw. You almost swallowed your tongue there. They were the maid to the Vicomtesse de Rambaud, the other a man he didn't recognize. The only person who had made threats against her was the Comte Saint-Germain. She thinks of the wine that had gone around, and that could have been the route through which she was poisoned. Master Raymond asks her if there is any way she might have upset the Vicomtesse. Claire remembers back to the scene in the alcove. The man whose face had been covered in snuff. The one who had been the foot fetishist. Raymond says that if it was her, she was likely safe from further attacks. Raymond then takes Claire into his hidden room behind the counter. Two walls were covered in shelves. Lots of skulls. Of animals, from bats to horses. Claire has seen the bones of martyrs treated with less reverence, she remarks, and she recognizes that he has the bones of a bear, or at least the skull of a bear.
He has a lot of bones in that background.
A lot of stuff. He says, yes, bears. They seldom starve because they eat meat, but also berries and grubs. They will eat anything. So the bear is symbolic of survival.
And garbage disposal.
And according to the same spirit animal website, the primary meaning of the bear spirit animal is strength and confidence, standing against adversity, taking action and leadership, indicates it's time for healing or using healing abilities to help self or others, and bear medicine emphasizes the importance of solitude, quiet time, rest, and providing strong grounding, and it provides strong grounding forces. So again, most of that may not apply. I just think it's interesting to look at. Ellen G. writes, Master Raymond trusts Claire so implicitly that he takes her into his inner workshop that carries his secrets. Looking at the skeletons, a bear, foreshadowing? They chat a bit about specific cranial landmarks, and then Claire points to his wolves. He says they are very old. We learn that he'd gotten those bones, the animals that were extinct, from a peat bog. Claire has slight PTSD in a flashback of her own wolf attack. She says, barely 6 months ago, or Diana writes, barely 6 months ago. You know, whenever we get these kind of references to time in this book, Summer, it's always surprising how little time has actually passed since Wentworth. It always freaks me out. I always think, like, new book, new year. I don't think it's 3 months or 4 months or 5 months later. She expresses that she has a bit more sympathy for the elk than other carnivores. Raymond says, sympathy, it is an unusual emotion to feel for a bone, Madonna. And yes, when I say, the word he uses, to refer to Claire from his lips, and I don't speak the language fluently at all. I say that word with an Italian accent. Don't ask me why. Madonna. I don't know. Claire describes her feelings about this. Quote, they don't really seem like just bones, you know. I mean, you can tell something about them and get a feeling for what the animal was like looking at these. They just aren't inanimate objects. Isn't this our first description of She Who Talks to Bones?
Probably. In the nature of this series? In the series, absolutely. Yes.
Raymond was smiling, apparently pleased by this. He wanted to show her something. She thinks, maybe, a sympathy for bones. He shows her to a cabinet that was, quote, painted with a number of odd signs, tailed and whorled, among what appeared to be pentagons and circles, Kabbalistic symbols. He pressed a number of places on the cabinet. He says...
Can I just say how funny it is that they're talking about Kabbalists, and he calls her Madonna, and I can't ignore the fact that Madonna is like a Kabbalist.
Oh, I'm thinking of what, the Mother of Christ?
No, like Madonna, like the pop singer, is a Kabbalist. So every time they're mentioning like
the Cabal,
and like Kabbalah, him calling her Madonna, whatever you want to say it, I always kind of chuckle to myself because I'm like, bah.
He pressed a number of places on the cabinet. He says the symbols help keep curious people out of his cabinet. It was a double cabinet, like a secret compartment at the bottom of a jewelry case or a traveling chest. From the secret compartment, he pulls out a large, white, crystalline stone and gave it to Claire. He says it's for protection. Hello, guardian much? He's also fingering what seems to be a lot of small colored gemstones.
I legitimately hate that term.
It's a very fine verb.
Fingering.
He's also fingering what seems to be a lot of small colored gemstones. He calls them the bones of the earth. He says, quote, they hold the essence of the matrix in which they grew, and whatever powers that held, you may find here as well. This might be an important thing to remember, no? Also, this makes me think of anatomy, and we know that Diana was and is a scientist, but taught anatomy and physiology, so she's extremely knowledgeable about this stuff. And I've studied a tiny, probably not even an inch of what she has, but this made me think of something from anatomy. The extracellular matrix is the stuff that holds our cells, and thus most of the body on the inside, together. And we will link to this in the show notes. The cells produce the molecules secreted into the matrix area and thus that make up the matrix. So the matrix itself is of our cells. That's what I think of when I hear matrix. And I know you're like, Ginger, whatever.
Okay, for the record, when I hear the word matrix, I think, of the Keanu movie? Reeves. And a bunch of like code, like green like letters like streaming up and down the screen of a computer. That's what I think when I think matrix.
You know... Matrix also means mother.
It means lots of things.
So, and Madonna. So, matrix.
I will buy that.
Mary.
I will join you on that journey.
In the Catholic Church, I believe she's...
But 100%, when you say matrix, I think of...
The movie.
Yes.
So, Raymond is saying that the stones hold the essence, or the stuff, of the matrix in which they grew. Isn't that awesome? This chapter is so much, Diana. She may talk medicine through Claire, but she also does so through Raymond. The bones, the stones, the earth.
Bones and stones. And earth. Doesn't rhyme. You need to find something else.
Then he pushes a small yellowish stone toward her. It's sulfur. Ground up with some other things, it can explode. He asks, does that mean that sulfur is magic, or is it only the nature of sulfur? She says it depends on whom you're talking to. And Raymond smiles and tells her, if you leave your husband, you would not starve, right?
Well, he pretty much said, you know, basically you're a professional. You are.
He reiterates that she is a professional, yes.
But, you know, in any other, like, circumstance, that would imply that she was a prostitute.
But a very good one.
But we all know she's not a
prostitute in the nature of this, and because of the nature of the relationship she has forged with Master Raymond, that he is thinking professional along his lines, where he is like an herbalist, a Kabbalist, a poison person, whatever, the person you go to get poisons and or kill people with. But he's saying, you will never starve because you have these skills at hand.
And you'll always be able to find a way to make money.
Yes.
Ellen G. writes, talking about the nature of things, like Claire's explanation of the bones and why she found comfort from them. And who understands the nature of things? This conversation, I think, adds so much more to Claire's 20th century thinking. It gives her more to work with when thinking on things, not just what you see is what you get. She's beginning to see the layers of things and is beginning to understand how to live in this time. Having her 20th century education won't help her here, and I think she finally begins to understand and see the layers upon layers of things around her, something that Jamie sees naturally, being a being of this time. I wrote, oopsie, she forgot Jamie! Before she leaves, Raymond gives her the white crystal. He says it is sensitive to poison. It will change color in its presence. So, apparently, she may still be in some danger. She leaves the hidden area and goes out to the counter area and finds Jamie. Raymond has been most helpful, she tells Jamie. Jamie seems actually pretty kind of relaxed once he sees her.
Yeah.
Once he sees her. I mean, I think the fact that she disappeared inside the shop was a little shock to him. I want to know, what do you think that crystal is made of? Like, a crystal that reacts to what poisons? They never specify. It just specifies that this particular crystal reacts to some really bad poisons.
Anyone who has knowledge of chemistry or stones, geology as well, although I think it's more of a chemistry question. In chemistry, a salt is a crystal.
Yes.
And a salt will usually dissolve in something.
But almost everything dissolves in water. Almost everything. Water is the ultimate solvent.
But not everything. A lot of stuff will.
I said almost.
But a lot of stuff. Okay. But what I'm saying is, so I have heard of crystals dissolving and then maybe a reaction between water or whatever it's dissolving in and the crystal, the salt, maybe part of that reaction results in a change of color of the liquid. I've never heard of an actual solid changing color in the presence of anything. And my guess is any poison he's talking about is likely going to be a liquid, although not necessarily. It could be in food. But who takes a stone and puts it in their food?
Well, I mean, but even the food in and of itself, maybe it's not a full liquid, but it would be somewhere between the two. Even if it was like in a sauce. Like, the sauce itself would be viscous enough that you would be able to use it. But I don't know. I mean, she's supposed to stick it in every meal she ever eats from here on out?
That's what I don't know. He didn't really give her any instructions.
I mean, she generally seems to trust the staff at her house, so she's not checking her food. It was when she was at Versailles that it was an issue, correct?
Yeah. Well, yes. Thus far. Raymond's reaction to Jamie is very interesting. He seems almost afraid, but he definitely seems overwhelmed. Is it Jamie's size? Raymond is barely 4 feet tall. Jamie is 6'4". He would barely shake Jamie's hand. And he couldn't, Diana writes, he could barely repress a shiver.
Well, let's be honest. Master Raymond, and you're going to put it in a French accent, is a very small, diminutive individual. Jamie is literally the polar opposite. He is large.
Mm-hmm.
He is wild in color. You know, I mean, he's got the red hair, the Scottish, you know, whatever. And then you have Master Raymond, who's this diminutive frog-ish person. So, I mean, they're like polar opposites. It would be definitely a little intimidating to come into contact with someone like Jamie when you are someone like Master Raymond. Am I wrong?
I just think there's more to it than number one, Jamie's size, and number two, the fact that he's a little intimidated by the fact that he may or may not. He definitely could have saved her life, potentially, right? By giving someone a fake poison. But
he also could have been. He 100% gave her a fake poison. It wasn't a poison that would kill her. It was a poison that could technically have rid her of the child she was carrying. It didn't.
Yes.
But it could have been damaging, but he definitely gave her the lesser of however many poisons they requested.
But that's what I'm trying to say. Even though he likely spared her life.
He was a businessman first.
He still caused her discomfort.
Absolutely.
Better than being dead. But he still, but by name, by,
is it
by
though, virtue. Is it though, if you were forced to take a giant like poop in front of like people you didn't know.
That was not a poop. That was explosive liquid.
Like I'm saying. Come on. That's what I'm saying though. Would that not have been equally as horrific as dying?
No.
There are some times when you wish you would have died. Right? You don't disagree? You don't think there are times
there's
when you're
no
like,
coming back from dead.
I know, but at least if you were dead, you wouldn't have to have the repercussions of experiencing that moment over and over again every time you met that
All
new
I'm
person.
Saying is, other than the fact that Jamie is so large, and you know, not just like tall, but like he's just a big guy.
So large.
And other than the fact that there's that little thing like, yeah, I mean, I actually did save her life, but yeah, she went through that because of what she got from someone else through me. He's a little scared of him because he's the wife of someone whom he basically kind of made ill for a little bit of time. So I get those two. But
and he's
there's
big.
Some.
But
I just said
be,
his
I
size.
I know, but what I'm saying is it's a combination of the two. Is it's not just.
There's more.
No, it's
there's
not
more.
Just that she's the wife of someone he possibly could have injured.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also a giant Scott, like a big guy.
I know,
like
but that's
he's
not
threatening
it.
And everything, and he's very diminutive. So, I mean, I think it's a combination of all of those things.
I mean, both of those things. There's only two.
There could be more. You're only saying two, but
no,
I think
you're only
more.
Saying two. I know it's more. I'm
okay.
trying to say
I,
it's not just that.
Okay.
But I was trying to say those two things. We both agree, but it's not enough, and even. In the writing, it seems that Claire is not convinced that it's only those two things. And later on in this book, we can't say it yet, but later on, one of the remarks, if I'm not mistaken, that Raymond makes, and we don't know any more background even once we have that remark. We don't have a background about it, but we may get a tiny bit more of a hint as to why he's feeling the way he is or reacting the way he does to Jamie. So he would barely shake Jamie's hand. He couldn't repress a shiver. Claire observes, quote, "The little apothecary seemed deprived of all his normal sly wit and huddled on a stool near the fire, shoulders hunched in wariness."
Okay,
he's on guard.
Absolutely, and I can totally relate to that because when we were on the plaid carpet at the premiere, I felt that way with Sam Heughan and Katrine Baum.
It's not the same thing.
It felt the same because I was like, they were like...
Right there
and in my face, and I felt that way. I was like, I was very uncertain.
Yeah, but it's not comparable to what Master Raymond. You were Twitter-pated and tongue-tied.
I didn't think they were going to murder me at any point because of something
and
I did.
You weren't scared of them.
I wasn't scared. I was definitely, like, I don't know, unnerved.
Sure.
For sure.
It wasn't till Claire was telling Jamie about the white crystal and poison protection that he chimed in again. He also mentions that he has heard the name Fraser spoken in a place where names are seldom named in blessing. They discuss the warning the Kabbalist signs Raymond has on his cabinet, and Jamie says that he plans to set Murta after the cult to observe him, which should be interesting. LNG writes, "So this adds a new level of trouble, involvement, searching for Jamie, and I am sure it is something he is really going to want to find out about since it involves Claire. And we know how much he loves to figure things out."
That's a pretty much a given. Nobody likes to leave anything hanging like that, you know. If you can figure out, I think most people want to figure it out.
If it's worth my time, I'm going to put the effort into it. If it's not, I won't. But with their path and their journey and things that they're trying to accomplish in this time period, I can't imagine any other outcome that makes sense to me. And that is chapter 16, The Nature of Sulfur. Please come back next week when we discuss chapter 17, entitled, very simply, Possessions.
Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
Last night, that my young love.